It's the Burt Cohen Show. What is the dream of America? Is it a solid economy? Is it one that works for all of us? Or is it one where we, the people, are, you know, second class and that it all works for the plutocrats in power, just like many other countries that existed before we created these United States? What is the role of employment here? Do we need to have full employment? It seems to have dropped off the map just a little bit in terms of priority. We all recognize now that the unemployment level is the highest since the Great Depression. High levels of unemployment historically have led to serious political destabilization, the rise of extremes like fascism and communism. We don't currently see that here, but it has affected the political spectrum. Our guest today, I'm very pleased, is Robert Pollan, a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, founding co-director of its famous Political Economy and Research Institute. They do some great stuff. 20 years ago, he was economic spokesperson for Jerry Brown's campaign for president. You didn't know I knew that, did you? He is author of Back to Full Employment, which we'll be talking about, which is put out by the MIT Press. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Bob Pollan. You argue that President Obama is trying to, in your words, patch up and restart the failed neoliberal model, when what we need is, in your words, a large-scale shift in the country's investment priorities. I wonder if you could say more about that. And let me ask, have we ever had the right investment priorities? Professor Pollan.
Yeah. I think we have, and I don't want to put the blame on President Obama so much. Obviously, he's a very powerful person as President of the United States, but it really is the overall tenor of the society where the political forces are, and as a politician, he will reflect where the political forces are. So it's more up to us to change the framing of the debate and what the priorities are. I think that it's hard to remember that we did have very different priorities, certainly coming out of World War II. Coming out of the Great Depression and World War II, the main priority of economic policy at the federal government level was indeed full employment. That was the centerpiece. Now, it doesn't mean that every political leader and at every moment that we were pursuing this with equal force and commitment, but that was the centerpiece, that you organize economic policy around the idea of creating decent jobs, an abundance of decent jobs, and everything else kinds of falls within that framework. That sensibility changes somewhere in the 1970s, and certainly by the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, when Ronald Reagan really emphasized the notion that the government was the problem, not the solution. Right. And among the problems created by government was the notion that if you try to use government tools to achieve full employment, you're going to just end up creating a lot of inflation, and you're not going to create any more jobs. Now, it wasn't Reagan that thought of this. It was what I could call neoliberal economists, the most prominent of whom was Milton Friedman, and he is certainly the intellectual godfather of neoliberalism. And among the very ideas that came out of that was this idea that all these tools that we developed over the course of 30 years, starting with the Great Depression, starting with the New Deal, they don't work. They never did work, and therefore the real issue is the government just kind of maintains a low inflation rate and then let the market rip.
Well, yes, the idea of a totally free market has undergone a lot of changes through the 200 years of the history of these United States. And certainly Republicans these days, I think, to a person, worship at the altar of St. Ronald Reagan. To what extent are we still suffering the consequences of the Reagan Revolution? And I want to make sure not to forget the question of inflation versus employment. So what about Reagan and the consequences of his revolution?
Well, again, it wasn't just Ronald Reagan, just like to say it's not just Obama. But yes, if you have to identify one person who transformed the framing of the debate. I mean, there's still a left and there's still a right. There's a difference between Democrats and Republicans. But the debate and the kind of parameters of economic policy shifted dramatically to the right, starting with Reagan. That was, he succeeded in that. The idea that government is not good at doing things. Government should not be involved in, for example, redistributing income, attempting to alleviate poverty, attempting to achieve full employment. That's not the job of government, and they can't do it well. And so right now, I mean, the debate around the fiscal cliff is still reflecting that, that even today when we have mass unemployment and we have not gotten out of the consequences of the Wall Street crash and Great Recession, what's the main focus of the debate? The main focus of the debate is the deficit, not jobs. So even just the premise of the debate is wrong. That, you know, where this notion, you know, fiscal cliff, something horrible is about to happen, therefore we have to cut, we have to think of ways to cut. Before we even get into the debate about which things to cut, the fact that we're talking about cuts as opposed to talking about job creation is a reflection of the transformation that's occurred in this country, and not only in this country, basically throughout the world, starting with the late 70s when Margaret Thatcher was elected in the UK and 80 when Reagan got elected in the U.S.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Professor Robert Pollan of Political Economy Research Institute at University of Massachusetts Amherst. And what about that question of full employment versus inflation? We haven't had much inflation in the past 10, 15 years or so. Is that because we have such high unemployment? What is the tie between the two?
Yeah. Well, the underlying idea is that at a very low unemployment rate, workers get more bargaining power because it's harder for businesses to find workers to fill their needs. So workers get more bargaining power, and they bargain up their wages. When that happens, then the idea follows that businesses will pass on their higher costs, their higher labor costs, by raising prices.
Right.
So you get inflation. So that's the basic idea. There is some truth in that idea, but it's very, very, very far from the whole story. So what happened in the 1970s, the period when we did have high inflation, it wasn't because workers had bargaining power. It was because of the oil shocks. So oil prices went up by 300% in 1973, and another 300% in 1979. That's what caused inflation. Now, the Milton Friedmanites used the occasion of the 1970s to say, well, this proves it. The government cannot promote full employment, and anyway, their efforts to do so are just going to lead to inflation. That's not really the lesson, but that's the lesson that the neoliberals extracted from the 70s, and that got really became decisive within my own field, the economics profession. People believe that, but it's the wrong message. Now, then let's take the case of the 1990s. Unemployment did go down. Unemployment in the late 1990s went below 4% briefly. We had almost no inflation. Now, why did we have almost no inflation? So does that mean this formula that there is an inevitable trade-off? When you get low inflation, low unemployment, you get high inflation. Well, it didn't happen. Now, why didn't it happen? Alan Greenspan himself, who was the head of the Federal Reserve at the time, gave an answer. And his answer was that workers in the United States were, in his words, this is a quote, traumatized. You have, quote, traumatized workers in the United States due to the effects of globalization. And so that even when you have a low unemployment economy, workers' bargaining power does not go up as much as it used to, because businesses can always say, fine, you want a raise? We're moving to China, or we're moving to Mexico. And that, even if they never move to Mexico or China, the fact that they could say with credibility that they have this option, that kept wage demands down. So the net result of all this is, after 40 years, from the early 70s until the present, the average wage for non-supervisory workers has gone down, is like 8% lower than it was. So we have had some brief periods of low unemployment, but they haven't caused inflation. We have had periods of high inflation, but it wasn't because of low unemployment. So there is this trade-off that one could think about, one could see, but it is a second-order problem, it's a third-order problem. It's not the main thing to be worrying about by any means, certainly not now. The main thing, we have no inflation in the economy and we have high unemployment, so let's solve unemployment.
It seems like we should be doing that, and there was talk, as I recall, during this recent election about jobs, jobs, jobs. And then, you know, now it seems to be talking about the deficit and our related national debt. It seems that the highest priority is that and not reducing unemployment. I thought the election was about jobs to a large extent. Whatever happened to that? And how much do you think that the election was about jobs?
Well, it's hard for me to say how much of the election was about jobs. I certainly think that if it was only about jobs, Romney might have done better, because the job situation really is bad.
Yeah.
I think that people thought that the election was about jobs, but that Romney was definitely not the guy to deliver a viable jobs program. So we did know all along about this fiscal cliff thing that got set up last year, which was a manufactured crisis.
Right.
Remains a manufactured crisis. Mm-hmm. The deficit today is large because we needed the government to spend money to keep us out of a 1930s level Great Depression. But fortunately, the interest rates at which the government is able to borrow are near zero.
Right.
So that the interest payments that the government is making now are actually close to a historic low, not a historic high. So if we take a common sense meaning of a fiscal crisis, which means, my God, we can't cover our obligations next month or in 2 months or in 3 months, that describes Greece, but it does not describe the U.S. by any way, shape, or form. We are not in a fiscal crisis. So then to have created this whole scare about a fiscal cliff and about the imperative of taking immediate action is a distraction. What we should be talking about is, the election's over, now let's solve the jobs crisis.
And there's a lot of jobs that certainly need to be done. You in your book, the new book, Back to Full Employment, we'll talk a little bit later on about the false dichotomy between jobs and the environment. It's really both, but some people make that discussion. And we've heard talk, of course, about right to work. The phrase right to work was just put into place. It was jammed in without any public hearing in the state of Michigan, of all places. The argument is that right to work does create more jobs by keeping expenses to potential employers in check. how does right to work affect unemployment? Does it bring unemployment down? Does it help create new jobs?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really interesting talking to you because listening to what you just said, it never actually occurred to me the phrase right to work really is the phrase that should animate my own book, Back to Full Employment. That means everybody has a right to work.
True.
So they have distorted this phrase and used it for a completely opposite purpose. Now, as I said, wages in this country have gone down for 40 years. So the average wage today, and these are from government statistics, for a non-supervisory worker is about $19 and some change, as opposed to $20 and change in 1972. So 40 years, no wage increases, wage decline. This is while productivity, the amount each worker produces in the course of a day, has essentially doubled. Again, not my numbers, government statistics. So productivity doubles, the pie doubles, the size of the amount people produce doubles, but workers don't get a raise. So this idea that, you know, they put out that saying, oh, we just need wages to go down further, and then we're going to create more jobs, is completely contradicted by the evidence of the last 40 years. We have had wage declines. We have deregulated the labor market. The share of workers belonging to unions has dropped precipitously in the last 40 years. The minimum wage is down. All of the things that the neoliberal types say is necessary to enhance job opportunities, all of these things have already happened. And what do we have? We have the worst employment situation since the Great Depression. So they're just wrong. They say it anyway, just because they don't like unions, they don't like workers getting good wages. It has nothing to do with improving employment.
And it does seem that it would appear to be part of the race to the bottom that brings on the whole outsourcing of jobs in the first place, just serving the interests of the entrenched corporate powers, Wall Street, the financial sector. They don't focus on full employment, certainly. And what about, you know, part of the equation, the whole financial sector, the people that got bailed out, too big to fall, the big commercial banks, as you point out in your book, they're sitting on something like $1.6 trillion. It's not in gear. It's not in the economy. It's just idling. Why are they sitting on these funds? What can be done to stimulate banks to invest in the economy? How realistic is it that they could be forced to invest at least some of that beyond the minimum they need for security?
Right. Well, yes, the banks are sitting on, the number has gone down slightly. It's now around $1.4
trillion. So, my heart bleeds for them.
It's about 10% of U.S. GDP is held in cash hoards by the U.S. commercial banks. Again, I'm not making these numbers up. It comes right from the Federal Reserve. And I just checked their most recent data. That's why I lowered it from 1.6 to 1.4. So they get the money for free,
right?
Because the Federal Reserve lends to the banks at zero interest rate. Literally, they get the money for free. On top of that, the Federal Reserve pays them 0.25% just to hold the money and do nothing with it at the Federal Reserve banks. I think this is one of the most severe problems we face, and policy-wise, it's outrageous. I wish there was a lot more attention paid to this, because if we could think about even moving half of the money into the economy, into the hands of small businesses so that they could create jobs and expand their operations, that alone would be the biggest source of new momentum, getting us out of the ditch, creating a lot of jobs. Now, analytically, it's very easy to think of how to do it. The easiest way is to think, well, we tax what we could call excess reserves.
Mm-hmm.
The banks have never held reserves at anywhere close to this level in any period where we have statistics. Why are they holding it? Number one, they say, well, wait a minute, guys. You all said we were too speculative, we were irresponsible, and that's what led to the crash. And it's true, they were, before, they weren't holding any reserves. I mean, almost nothing.
Wow.
$20 billion for the whole economy in 2007. So we went from $20 billion for all the banks in 2007 to $1.6 trillion, which is now $1.4
right.
But basically, essentially 0 to 10% of GDP the banks are holding. Now, that the 1.4 is way, 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 way more than any reasonable calculation would establish for what they need to stay safe, to have a nice cash cushion for
right.
any kind of problem.
Right.
You could make an argument that, okay, maybe they need, you could say they need to hold on to $500 billion or $600 billion. Well, that still moves $800 billion into the economy. So that's 5% of GDP in new credit for small business. Like I said, if that money were moved into the economy, we would be in a much different situation.
Now, how can that be made to happen? Can there be stimulus like tax incentives? Or does it need to be, can they be forced to invest that?
Well, you can't put a gun to their head, at least not that I know of. But you can tax it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I proposed in the book. The tax would be, I don't know what the exact rate should be,
mm-hmm.
but we say, okay, here's what we consider a reasonable level of reserves. Again, keep in mind that we are giving this money out for free.
Right.
We are keeping the banks going with this money. We're giving them a huge advantage. Now, in exchange for that advantage, there has to be some accountability. They have to do something with the money. So here's the deal. You say, okay, if you don't want to put this money into the economy, then we're going to tax it. And you could keep X amount, let's say $700 billion, $800 billion, and then the rest, we're just going to tax it away from you because you're not going to do anything with it. I'm not the only one that has proposed this. Actually, some conservative economists have proposed variations on this, and I think it's something we really need to do. It's really unfortunate that it has not been part of the discussion about getting out of the recession.
Again, we're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Robert Paulin, professor of economics at the University of Mass Amherst, co-director of its Political Economy Research Institute, talking about his new book, Back to Full Employment, put out by MIT Press. So the banks are these big banks, and I'm reminded back in the late 70s, Gore Vidal was talking about some monstrous entity called the bank. Seems to be there now, perhaps stronger than even then. What's the excuse that the banks give to not invest? I mean, it is a shaky economy. Don't they need to be extra prudent? What's their argument for hoarding all these hundreds of billions of dollars?
Well, first of all, you know, I read the financial press. I don't know. They don't say anything. I just have not seen, I've seen very little coverage on this point. I myself have tried to get it out. There was some coverage in the Huffington Post of our research on this, and I have a friend who is a reporter at the New York Times, and I was sending him the material, but it just has not been a major issue. I think it should be. So I don't know. Here's what I think their argument is. I think their argument is, look, we're in business to make money. If we saw profitable lending opportunities, of course, we would pursue them. And therefore, we don't see the opportunities, and therefore, we're not lending. I don't think that's a legitimate argument. And the reason is, I know from survey evidence that small businesses are applying for loans and are getting turned down at
yes.
a very, very high,
yes.
high rate.
Mm-hmm.
So the small businesses themselves are ready to expand. Now, of course, some of them are risky. I just think that, for one thing, the banks have gotten used to not being involved in productive activities.
Hmm.
A lot of the banks are getting the money for free, and then B, they're thinking, let's wait for the next bubble. And then when the next financial bubble comes along and we can invest in whatever the bubble is, whether it's real estate or the stock market or oil prices or food prices, let's wait for that next bubble, invest, and make a short-term killing. I think that's really their mentality now. So they have to be forced back into thinking of themselves as serving the communities, which to a very large extent they are not doing.
No, it seems like this is a little bit blunt, that they think that we are there to serve them, and they don't seem to be getting any pushback on that. So they have gotten this money basically for free. They're not really paying taxes on this money that they're just hoarding. Could that technique, the idea of you know, too big to fail, and to keep them from falling, they were given this money by we the people, could that be realistically applied to other sectors of the economy? But you know, it seems like the money is there in the big banks, and somehow that has to be, as you suggest, taxed. But I wonder about, is it too, I mean, you can see the banks, they're a clearly definable entity that were tottering there for a while because of their own, you know, casino-like behavior. But could our tax dollars be used to prop up other sectors of the economy?
Well, let's take the example of the auto industry. I mean, they were bailed out also. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things about the bailout that I didn't like, especially the limits on wage increases and the imposition of a two-tier wage system with lower wages for younger workers. So that's a problem. But there were some terms put on the auto companies, in particular in terms of accepting very aggressive auto efficiency standards. So miles, fuel efficiency standards are going up quite dramatically, and that is going to have an extremely positive effect on fighting climate change over the next 20 mm-hmm. years. And so the standard by 2025 is that the cars have to be at 54.5 miles per gallon, which is amazing. Roughly double where we are now. So we did force them. We said, okay, this is what you have to do. You know, you got our money. Now you have to do something for the public good. I would have liked to have seen better terms in terms of mm-hmm. wages and benefits for workers as well. But at least we got some stuff. Now, with respect to the banks, essentially we got nothing in return for bailing them out. I think that was a huge mistake, remains a huge mistake, and that's why it's still time to think about these kind of attacks.
Well, perhaps we can do that. Now, you know, we talk about government getting involved in the economy and you know, participating in it, not being left out of it. There are many on the right who have been in power for a long time who have argued that just leave the free market alone, that that'll be all the solution we need. I wonder if that is starting to fade a little bit. What's your sense of that, Professor Pollan?
Well, you know, the free market proponents really, for the most part, are not free market proponents. They're pro-business. That's different. If they were truly the true free market proponents would have said, you know, when the banks are in big trouble, let's let them fail. That's what the free market is all about. If you screw up, too bad. Down you go. Now, even there may be some people that thought that way, but even a lot of them would say, we can't let Goldman Sachs fail. We can't let J.P. Morgan fail. We can't let Bank of America fail because it's going to bring down the whole economy. Now, that happens to have been true. It is inconsistent with the free market logic, though. So if we really, really, truly were to impose the logic of free market capitalism, we would be in a Great Depression right now. It would be worse than the 1930s because the severity of the bubble was worse than the 1930s. The only thing that stopped it from being a 1930s experience was the government intervention. For everyone maligns it, but that's the truth. So the free marketeers don't really have much of an argument. You know, they've gotten most of what they wanted. You can always find something that's not right. But like I said, the labor market, the job situation is really to their liking. It's highly unregulated. Workers' union bargaining power is very weak. The minimum wage is lower than it was in 1968 after correcting for inflation. So this is all the things that the free marketeers want. The financial markets were deregulated, so you could engage in any casino-type activity, speculative activity you wanted. This is what free marketeers have been calling for, and they've gotten it. They got it. So the trouble is, when you get that, you know, it creates a disastrous economy, and that's what happened.
The only person during the presidential election who seemed to be talking at all about the Federal Reserve was Ron Paul. Of course, we see how well he did. What about Federal Reserve policy? People are not, I think, largely familiar with that, how really free they are from oversight, public oversight, and being responsive to the government. Are they? How much impact does a Federal Reserve policy have? Are they actually encouraging the big banks to sit on their hoard?
No. I think the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve, given the alternatives and compared with, say, Congress or compared with the central bank in Europe, the Federal Reserve is doing a decent job. They, at the very least, are making it clear that they are trying to solve unemployment. They don't have all the tools, and they're not willing to use all the tools they have. For example, what I'm saying is they could impose the equivalent of this tax on reserves, and they're not doing it. But they are, at the very least, engaged in thinking about unemployment. And Ben Bernanke, the chair, just said last week that he's going to keep interest rates at zero until we at least get unemployment down to 6.5%. And he also said that he doesn't think that's going to happen this year. He said unemployment's going to stay between 7.3% and 7.7%. So he, I think, among the heavy figures, the main figures in the world of economic policy, I think he's doing reasonably well. The problem, in my critique of Bernanke, is not that he has a zero interest rate policy, but that he, like I said, he's letting the banks take the money, but he's not forcing them to do anything useful with the money. If he were to do that, then again, I think that would be transformative.
I wonder if there are any people in Washington who are pushing for that. Do you hear any voices at all calling for, some requirements that the big banks, now that they've gotten all this bailout, that they be responsive and show that they are, in fact, serving the common good? Is there any voice doing that?
No. I found it very, very frustrating. And I might as well say this, and hopefully some of your readers will put pressure on Senator Bernie Sanders, who I've actually written the memos to Senator Sanders at the request of his office on this point, and then it never goes anywhere. I'm even on Senator Sanders created an advisory board on Federal Reserve policy, and I'm a member of it. And I've made this point to in our discussions of the advisory board. It never goes anywhere, even though this is even Senator Bernie Sanders.
Really?
And I just can't get any person in Congress to take this seriously. I have had discussions with staffers. I have given talks in Washington. And I honestly don't know why it doesn't go anywhere, even with Bernie Sanders.
That is surprising. I mean, you would think, like any parent, you give a kid the car, he or she has to be responsible. You know, they have a job to do. They have, a part of the economy that is exceedingly important to millions of people. And to say that, okay, here's the money, do with it whatever you want, that's just amazing to me. That's incredible.
Yeah, I like your analogy. I'm going to use that.
Okay.
I like that analogy. Yeah, it is amazing. So for any of you that are listening that know Senator Sanders, who and I have huge admiration
sure,
for.
Sure, as do I.
But I cannot get him. And this is what, after he asked me, not him, but his staff, asked me to draft a jobs proposal, and this was the centerpiece of the proposal. And it just didn't get anywhere. And then even more recently, they said that Senator Sanders was... Ben Bernanke was appearing before the Joint Economic Committee, of which Senator Sanders is a member, and they asked me to draft questions that Sanders could ask of Bernanke. And again, I came right back to the same point, and again, he completely ignored it and talked about other stuff.
It's amazing. You would think if anybody would do it, that Bernie Sanders. And I wonder, you know, you can see a lot of the U.S. senators who, you know, that house was created to be the House of Aristocrats originally. It kind of seems like it still is, how much they're still in the service of the plutocrats and, you know, campaign finance reform yet again. And, you know, who are they working for? Are they working for the big banks or for, you know, the common good?
I think they're working for the big banks for the most part. But the point is that, you know, the interests of the big banks became so completely discredited as a result of the crisis that did open up the discussion. And I give Sanders a lot of credit for standing up and raising points. As long as, you know, we're not just going after easy targets, but, you know, let's set a hard target, Senator Sanders. I think he is great at raising the issues and pounding on issues of social injustice. I think he's great
at it. Absolutely.
I don't think he's good at taking seriously concrete steps to change things. I don't think he is. And that's my own experience around these financial issues is a case in point. If he could bring this up, it would get out and it would be discussed in Congress, and then I would hope a lot of people would see it as a thoroughly sensible idea. But it needs a voice.
And people have to raise that voice. We all know that, people raising their voices still does matter in these United States. It absolutely still does matter.
Absolutely.
I mean, they hear it. They want to get reelected, and they hear it. One thing that I have learned in looking at American history is that the one thing that we learn from history is that we never learn from history. And, you know, under FDR... with whom I certainly have some disagreements, but let's, you know, reality is John Maynard Keynes' economics held sway under Franklin Roosevelt, and the application of his stimulus economy, economics, unquestionably saved the economy, saved capitalism itself. How the heck did we move away from Keynes' demand-side economics, which is clearly what we have now? We have to increase demand to stimulate demand. How the heck did we move away from that and replace it with the Chicago School, the Milton Friedman, who argued that governments could increase employment only at the risk of causing inflation to accelerate? Was there some conscious effort to dump Keynes?
Yes, certainly the conscious effort started, you know, day one. I mean, for example, the financial regulation laws that were put in place under Roosevelt, the so-called Glass-Steagall regulatory system, which, you know, for the most part was quite effective
for
35 years. Wall Street was screaming about that from day one. They were trying to get rid of it. They succeeded. It took them two generations, but they succeeded. Meanwhile, they were against it from day one. The Keynesian approach of, again, focusing on full employment and how you get there, using government tools to get there, there was always opposition. The opposition was in the minority.
Right.
It became the majority. Certainly the Chicago School, Milton Friedman, they were against it from day one, but it became, it was kind of out in the wilderness for a long time, but it was really in the 1970s with, as we talked about before, the high inflation caused by the oil prices. It gave them an opening to say, look, this is the real problem with running this economy is inflation. We can't be bothered. Unemployment will take care of itself. The free market takes care of unemployment because in a free market, if you want a job, you bargain with an employer. if you don't like the wage,
take it or leave it.
Lower your wage until you'll get a job, and that's the logic. The government, they say, the government can't do anything about that. If you have skills, somebody's going to hire you at a wage you deserve. And that's what the free market can
do. A lot of people still believe that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really work. Now, while we're on the subject of history, Professor Pollan, LBJ, people, as soon as you think of Lyndon Johnson, of course, unfortunately, you think of the war in Vietnam. But aside from that, what was his approach to the economy, and how well did it work? He was a big fan of FDR and seemingly wanted to continue with that. Aside from Vietnam, how well did his approach work on the economy?
Well, his approach was a continuation, more or less, of the FDR, of the New Deal era. You start to have inflation, not serious inflation. You have very low unemployment at the end of the 1960s, below 4%, where we need to be now. You do start to get some inflationary pressures, 3-4% inflation, which is no big deal, easy to manage, but anyway, it was emerging. And actually, I saw an interview with Johnson when he was asked about this, and he says, of course I'm not going to try to stop inflation at that level because that may hurt employment, and we want to run a full employment economy.
Mm.
He was the last president to say such things and mean it because he was reflecting his times and the spirit of the New Deal. And that spirit continued, weirdly, it continued a little bit even into the presidency of Richard Nixon. But it was really, I have to say, it was really kind of the transition away from it started more under Jimmy Carter in 77 than it did under Nixon. And then you get this full-scale reversal under Ronald Reagan.
So that's when it happened. But I would think, I mean, I certainly see Keynes' ideas and FDR's programs as being exceptionally applicable to today's situation as opposed to...
Oh, they're totally applicable, perfectly applicable. And even people after the Wall Street crash, which led to the Great Recession, people realized that briefly. What then happened is we got a big deficit, fiscal deficit from the federal government, and they said, look, the stimulus failed, the deficit is a disaster. If the stimulus was such a good thing, then how come unemployment isn't down to, near zero? Which is a false argument. The reason the unemployment is still high is because the magnitude of the financial crisis was so severe. The financial crisis wiped out $17 trillion in household wealth. Now, you're not going to see households just start spending all of a sudden, even with a stimulus program, because the value of their homes is down.
Right.
They lost their jobs. They're facing heavy debts. So the stimulus did help, but the problem is much deeper, and the stimulus could not solve it by itself. We still need government stimulus, and we still need to move money into the economy, and we can't be focused just on the deficit.
If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Robert Pollan. He's co-director of the Political Economic Research Institute at UMass Amherst. We're talking about his new book, Back to Full Employment. And looking at history, I find it fascinating getting back again to FDR. He gave a wonderful speech October 31st, 1936, to a big rally at Madison Square Garden, where he said, and I can't remember exactly, that in his first administration, basically the big corporations met their match. In his second administration, they're going to meet their master. And he said that to wild cheers. He didn't follow through on that. I think there's still a lot of people who see that, well, Obama's approach, stimulus, didn't work. He spent $800 billion, something like that. It didn't work. Is there an argument that's being heard at all that the private sector should, in fact, be subservient to the public sector? In a capitalist system, should the government set controls on finance and policies to either promote certain industrial aspects and de-emphasize others. Should the public sector be subservient to the public sector?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if the right word is subservient, but I think that the public sector in a capitalist economy is absolutely necessary to establish the overall framework for guiding the economy to decent jobs, to protecting the environment, to maintaining some reasonable standard of fairness, such that we don't have such extremes of inequality, such extremely high levels of poverty, that people have the right to decent education and health care. Those things don't happen on their own in a free market setting. We didn't get, for example, in terms of industrial policy and technology, the internet didn't come out of the free market. The internet came out of 35 years of government subsidies within the Pentagon, the most important single technology of the last generation was an entirely a government-sponsored operation. You can't expect an individual capitalist to make the necessary investments for research and development, commercialization, nurturing this over many, many years, for them to do this on their own. That requires the government. Even if a business person was even thinking of doing it, another business person could say, good, let them nurture this crazy new technology for the next 15, 20 years, see how it goes. And then I can steal it. I can just copy them. That's why you can't get the private sector to invest in these long-term technological developments on their own. You need the government. It's imperative. It just doesn't happen any other way. And I've never heard a free market economist give a reasonable alternative explanation. So in order for there to be technological advance, in order for there to be something akin to full employment, something akin to protecting the environment and fighting climate change, the role of the government is central. Whether or not, you know, they're the master and who's the servant, I guess that's a matter of emphasis. But you do need a strong public sector, a public sector committed to, you know, the principles of equality, the principles of fairness, ecology, financial stability.
And that's just plain good business. It's good economic, it's not just being nice. It works for the economy. I wonder about, the military budget is maybe a model. I mean, it's a massive, massive budget. They create jobs. They create a lot of jobs in a rather Keynesian manner, I believe. But I wonder about job creation in terms of dollars into the military budget versus non-military investments, if there could be something along those lines. I mean, it was World War II, as a lot of historians recognize, that ended the war, ended the Depression, because it was massive federal spending.
Right. There's no question that's what happened. That's what ended the Great Depression.
Yes.
As much as I admire a lot of the New Deal programs, by 1937, the federal government again moved into
sputtering.
The kind of mode we're in now, where the priority became deficit reduction, austerity,
yes.
And we went right back to 14% unemployment.
Yes.
Pearl Harbor is attacked. A year and a half later, unemployment falls to 1.5% because we get mobilized for war, and there's no constraint on the level of government spending to fight the war. So the federal deficit goes up to 25% of GDP. In 2010, we were at 10% of GDP, which is very high, but a whole lot less than 25% of GDP. So it was a government spending at that level, and spending on war, which mobilized people, which created a lot of jobs automatically, that's what ended the Great Depression. Now, the point is that it was not the war that ended the Depression. It was the spending by the government that was legitimized by the needs of war. So we can, if there's the political will, we can undertake investment projects that will create a lot of jobs, a lot more than military. We can invest in the green economy. We can invest in education. Those things create many more jobs for a given amount of spending. Just to take an example, spending on education creates 27 jobs per $1 million of spending. Military creates 11 jobs per $1 million of spending. So you get 250% more jobs for a given amount of spending by supporting education than the military.
And it's also true that we would hope that a lot of the dollars invested in the military make things that just hopefully are just going to gather dust and sit on a shelf, whereas education and building bridges and roads and investing in our infrastructure pays off for the long term. And certainly, Professor Pollan, you know, Obama has talked a lot about green jobs to restore employment, and detractors have said, well, the government shouldn't be picking winners. How much of a solution, in your analysis, are green jobs, and what are the obstacles to having green jobs? How much of a factor are those?
Well, I'm a very strong supporter of the idea of investing in the environment, both for environmental reasons, because we have to, because otherwise we're playing Russian roulette with our environment because of the threats of climate change destroying our ecological foundations.
For sure.
Okay, so we have to. Now, the argument that goes against that is, well, if you do that, if you invest in the environment, that's fine, but then you're going to slow down the economy when we're going to lose a lot of jobs and people are going to suffer. What I find is that that's not true. Investing in the green economy is an excellent source of job creation. So let me give you another set of statistics. If you spend on the green economy, investing in building the green economy in the U.S., you create, for every $1 million of spending, you create 17 jobs, thereabouts. If you spend the same money on maintaining our fossil fuel-based and nuclear-based energy system, you only create 5 jobs. So here again, you get 3 times more jobs by investing to build a green economy than you do by maintaining our fossil fuel economy. So investing green is good in both ways. It's good environmentally, and it's good for jobs. So that should be a major priority, and Obama made it a major priority in 2009 when he first came in. He has kind of weakened on that a lot most recently, but I'm hoping it's going to come back.
Well, what about the idea, the criticism that the government shouldn't be picking winners?
Well, the government doesn't pick winners per se. We definitely pick winners and they say, we don't want to destroy the planet. I guess that's picking a winner. Let's see. Here are your choices. Threat of total ecological catastrophe or solving the problem. Which one do you pick? Now, once we pick the rational choice, there's a lot of things that the government can do without saying this company is good, this company is bad. So you set the environment, you create subsidies, and then you let private companies compete for the opportunities. Some of them will succeed, some of them will fail. The one famous case, Solyndra, the Northern California Solar Company, they got a $500 million loan that was guaranteed by the government. It was a private loan. It was not a government loan. So a private bank made the loan to Solyndra. The federal government underwrote the loan, guaranteed it, and now that Solyndra has failed, the government has to cover that $500 million. Now, within that overall program where Solyndra got its money, there was a total of $16 billion that went out in loans. So Solyndra failed, 2 other companies failed, that meant $600 million of failures, but then that also meant $14.4 billion of successful loans that the government underwrote. So that looks like a good deal to me, that we got $14.5 billion, more or less, in investments in the green economy. So it wasn't picking winners. There's a lot of companies that have really succeeded and are going to move us forward in investing in the green economy.
Certainly, and there's so much potential growth there that obviously makes us stronger as well, aside from just the jobs it creates. It makes us more economically secure. I like what you said, that when properly defined, full employment is fundamental to building a decent society. And I don't think really there can be any sense of real freedom without some level of economic security. Just to finish off here, we could talk for another hour or so. Fascinating analyses here. What are the prospects, Dr. Pullen, for an effective political mobilization to set a new course, to push for full employment as a top priority?
You know, I'm not really the best expert to answer that question. For example, I was last week, I spoke at the convention of the National Nurses Union, which is
one of the most
innovative unions, maybe the most innovative in the country. And it's people like that that really know what our prospects are better than me. But my sense is that we have this huge opening, the opening created by the financial crisis and Great Recession, to think about an entire new set of priorities. And it doesn't happen, I know it doesn't happen overnight, but as long as we're going to talk about jobs, let's not just talk about patching up the system that failed. Let's talk about a transformative agenda that is going to create opportunities for people. We are capable of doing it. We are even capable of doing it within a framework of capitalism.
Yes.
Some people are going to still make a lot of money and get rich. People have opportunities to invest, innovate, fail. But still, we should have the undergirding be that everyone who is seeking a job has the opportunity to get a decent job.
It can happen. I believe I'm with you. The book is Back to Full Employment, MIT Press. The author we've been speaking with is Robert Pullen, who is co-founding director of Political Economy Research Institute at the UMass Amherst. It is all about jobs. Thank you so much for being with us. Very fascinating.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much. And it is, as we say, about jobs. I'm here to sing about it.
Get working.
Jeff Beck.
Boom, 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 boom